Sunday evening checklist. Meal prep done, clothes laid out, and your fantasy NFL team picked for Paddy Power Fantasy's massive £3 million prize pot fantasy game. First place wins £1 million. And because Paddy Power Fantasy games last only as long as the game week, we'll have a winner by Monday. You could pay someone to lay out your clothes on Sundays. Only £9 to enter, and last entry by 6 p.m. Sunday. Paddy Power Fantasy. Hate waiting, love winning. Paddy Power Fantasy rules apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show, presented by Paddy Power Fantasy. Good to have you with us in a jam-packed show coming your way. We'll check in with Iron Mike Carlson very soon, and a lot to be getting into with the big man. We'll look back at Monday Night Football and those unbeaten 49ers. Bit of MVP chat as well. Mike will tell us what makes a great quarterback. We'll dive into the mailbag as well, and plenty more besides. So looking forward to getting stuck in. Just a quick bit of housekeeping. Follow us on social media at the NC Show, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're pushing stuff out all week long. Bonus video goes out on Friday as well, as it does on the ESPN UK channel. Ben Isaac's in the studio on Friday, so I'll have an extra bit of college chat with Ben to four episodes a week. So if you're new to the show, listening to us for the very first time, don't forget to subscribe on whichever podcatcher you are catching us on, and you won't miss a trick. Right then, let's get this show well and truly on the road and check in with Iron Mike. Iron Mike, what's occurring?
Well, I can't talk long because I've got a couple of phone calls from Landover, Maryland on the other line. And I think we're discussing a possible job with a certain organization that will
be unnamed
in the NFL.
Breaking news. How about that?
I've offered to do it very cheaply, but they're more concerned with being able to take all the blame if things go badly and not get any of the credit if things go well. And I said, well, I thought that went without saying with this job.
Yeah, it's a little bit exciting. It's quite a little bit like working on this show, I think. You and Dan Snyder, of course, is a match made in heaven. So I think that's a great shout. Mike, lots to get into today. We're gonna talk a bit of Patriots. Surprisingly, given the fact they are on an absolute tear, we haven't paid much lip service to the champs this season. And who better than to get into that with Iron Mike and work out what this current incarnation of the Pats looks like and how it's built, because there are some interesting things I think Mike has got to say about that. We're going to talk the MVP race as well. And seeing as quarterbacks are all the rage, backup quarterbacks specifically, we're going to break down those different tiers of quarterbacks, trying to avoid the word elite, because I know that will just wind you up. But what's the difference between a great quarterback, a good quarterback, a so-so, a backup, the mechanics and the makeup of what makes a great quarterback? And that will segue fluently into Iron Mike's top five /6/7 of the week, which is Iron Mike's top five quarterbacks ever. And I've got inspired by Ollie, our producer, on that one, Iron Mike, because you've got your top five all-time great quarterbacks. And I thought, I'm going to put down my five desert island quarterbacks. So if I could take on a desert island and say an hour game footage of five quarterbacks that I've seen, not necessarily in the flesh, but I've watched since I was a kid, my five favorite quarterbacks, they might be the five best, but my five favorites, so I can just watch footage again and again. So I'm going to throw that back at you a little bit later on.
Better be a pretty big desert island.
They're not going to literally be there. I'm just going to watch them on an iPad or something. Or any tablet would work. It's quite friendly. Okay, let's start with Monday Night Football. That's what we get into first. And those 49ers have had their best start to a season since 1990, going unbeaten. The defense just bringing it to Baker Mayfield, quite literally. Did you see Nick Bosa in the locker room afterwards? Like, some great comments from him, who, of course, has got a bit of history with Baker. It goes back to the college days when Baker Mayfield riled Bosa at the Ohio State connection there. And Nick Bosa didn't hold back in his post-match media comments, saying, we were just calling him out, Baker, come on, make it competitive, and having a lot of fun at the expense of the fairly gregarious and confident Baker Mayfield. So, yeah, his defense getting it done, Mike.
Yeah, well, it was more – he actually did it during the game because when Oklahoma played Ohio State, Mayfield had this big Oklahoma flag.
That's right.
He took out in the middle of the field and then, you know, did the kind of jumping on the Ohio State logo and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So when Bosa sacked him, he did this – he sort of mimicked waving that huge flag and doing the dance and all that. So it was a moment of some satisfaction for Bosa. And this is kind of his arrival game in the NFL. Although, you know, having said that, the offensive line for Cleveland, especially the tackles, is particularly weak. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, when we were at, Spurs for the game about, seemingly the Bears coming out a bit flat in the, in the first half. Cleveland came out so flat. You would have thought they'd taken like a reverse red eye to get out there to San Francisco.
It's quite possible with Freddie Kitchens running the show, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, and they were, you know, they did not play badly at times. They just could not string anything together. And you can see it on the very first run of the game, their very first offensive play when Matt Breida goes 83 yards. You know, Olivier Vernon has a good shot at him and just stands there and doesn't take it. And then Demarius Randall, who's the safety, takes an incredibly silly angle, you know, basically lets him run past him and then tries to chase him and couldn't catch him. And, you know, you take that 83-yard run out of the game, and then, you know, you take away a couple of other plays, and it's a completely different game. But the Browns managed to do what they could not to get themselves back in. And what I'm thinking of in particular is, a really bad performance, I thought, by Antonio Callaway.
Yep.
You know, who, although having said that, the commentators and he shall go nameless on that place, and a perfect pass from Baker Mayfield, just a little behind him and low and which it was, but there was another pass in the end zone where Callaway, Mayfield threw it where he had to, which was above Callaway, and Callaway made a kind of half-hearted, one-handed effort to go up for it because he was looking at the safety who was about to smother him, cream him if he made the catch. And so
you know, one of the reasons for that, Mike, Ollie, our producer, said to me before the end of our radio show on Sunday, loving Callaway as a touchdown scorer on Monday, loving that. Really, really good tip there. So it was inevitable once he'd given us that inside skinny.
Absolutely. You know, and then, you know, Emmanuel Mosley made a great play to tip a touchdown away from him in the end zone. And, Odell Beckham was better as a passer than a receiver in this game. I mean, sure. he had a terrible drop, and you know, I thought Nick Chubb was doing what Nick Chubb can do. They just weren't able to put anything else together because whether it's Mayfield and his receivers aren't on the same page, whether his receivers aren't paying attention to, you know, what's supposed to be going on. And Ricky Seals-Jones nearly made a great catch with Richard Sherman draped all over him, but, you know, but he couldn't get his toe down. He got his heel down instead of his toe, and his toe was already out of bounds. So, you know, it was one of those games where it doesn't necessarily look as bad as it looks, although when you're outgained, I think it was 450 yards to 180, more or less, you kind of expect to lose. The time of possession on this one was I noted it down, 37-43 to 22-17, which is generally the indication of a bad loss. Although having said that, the time of possession was almost the same in the Indianapolis Kansas City game, which was 19 to 13.
Lots of things on Mayfield's shoulders, obviously, after another defeat in his worst performance as a pro, I think, statistically and otherwise. And given the hype they had preseason, many people looked at them as, you know, a dark horse Super Bowl tip. They seem to believe that hype as well. Their season's now in, if not tatters, then certainly they are up against it. How much of that is on Freddie Kitchens? How much of it is on Mayfield? Because, you know, it talked about the gregariousness of Baker Mayfield, and working with Jay Bell and OC yesterday, and Jay Bell incidentally on the show next week, plug that, and they were saying how disrespectful Mayfield was. Even at the start of the game, he wasn't going to shake the captain's hands. He was just being difficult to players like Sherman and serious vets, that it's just rubbing people up the wrong way, and it's a dangerous game to play, Mike, isn't it?
It is, but to be honest, Richard Sherman was making a meal of this before that happened during the week and conducting the NFL on social media. I know everybody loves to hype it up and get all excited about it, but realistically, that's not the way that things play out. I mean,
what do you mean, though? Because Mayfield he does wind up his opposition more than most other players.
Some players wind up the opposition. Everybody says, oh, look at that. That's great. He puts them off their game. Richard Sherman winds up the opposition.
Sherman's got it done. He's got 11 years as one of the top players in his position in the NFL. Mike Mayfield's been here for a cup of coffee.
Absolutely. But, you know, but once it works, it works. This is what we understand, as opposed to what's going on in the football field, which we don't necessarily understand. And the dynamic between Mayfield and his receivers and Kitchens and his offense, we're not sure yet of where that stands. Remember, he's only a second year quarterback, and Bill Barnwell made a really good point comparing Mayfield's second year with Drew Brees' second year. Mm-hmm. And Brees being someone who, at least stature wise, he compares with very, very closely. And Brees in his second year got benched for Doug Flutie, who was at that point 41 years old. And then they drafted Philip Rivers, and let Brees go a year later. Yeah. And so in that case, quarterbacking, which we're going to discuss, is often a mix of a quarterback and an offense and a coach. And I think part of the thing with Cleveland is that Freddie Kitchens did a great job last year of converting or changing the whole ethos of the Browns offense. Mm. But this year he has to change the whole ethos of the team. And he's dealing with a lot of really outsized personalities who have to buy in to what it is he's trying to do. And this is one of those things we talked about it a little a few weeks ago, and I'm sure we'll talk about it some more. The idea of bringing offensive guru head coaches in with no head coaching experience, has its pitfalls. And a lot of those pitfalls have to do with team construction. He's not the kind of guy. It's not his nature. And he doesn't have the reputation either to bring with it to kind of knock guys into line. Who are hard, you know, if Tom Coughlin can't keep OBJ can't keep his focus on the game. And when I say into line, that's all I'm really talking about. You know, all this kind of, social media stuff doesn't bother me at all. As long as a guy keeps his focus on the game.
Sure.
Richard Sherman delivered, and he delivered big, in that game. But, you know, you want to see OBJ deliver the way he did against the Jets when he came back to New York, you know, because every game is like that. You don't need a special occasion to have to get up for it, especially when you're a contender like Cleveland is in a division that at this point seems still wide open.
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. The 49ers unbeaten and getting their running game going as well. Garoppolo looking a bit more composed. They're not necessarily winning because of him, but he's not risking games in the way that people thought maybe at the start of the season he would. So good news for them. So let's roll into the other unbeaten team in the NFL right now, Mike, the New England Patriots, who many things I want to ask you about, particularly the construct of this current Patriots incarnation. And the offense in particular, I want to get your sense of how you feel that is working. But a lot of people are pointing out their vanilla schedule, and it's something they can't control. They can't help being in the AFC East, and the Bills, I guess, are obviously more competitive than many in the AFC, frankly. But the Jets and the Dolphins are two of the worst teams in the NFL, let alone in that conference. So they've got an automatic advantage there. Is it difficult to gauge just how good this Patriots side is because of that?
It's very difficult to do that. And the other thing is, you know, there are six bad teams in the NFL right now, and Denver and Arizona picked up their first wins. So, you know, they're automatically promoted out of the list of losers. But of the other four, two of them are in the AFC East and two of them are in the NFC East. And the Patriots this year have drawn the NFC East as the division they play. So therefore they have six games against the four worst teams in the league, which is a gift in a sense, but the other teams in their division will do that. We're going to have some great kind of loser bowl games, tank bowl games when the Jets play the Giants, when the Redskins Miami this weekend,
exactly. The Dolphins will blow it.
That's got to be, I mean, that's really one that you should put you know, in prime time because it's got so much riding on it. But it's hard to judge how good the Patriots are, particularly the defense, because they haven't been challenged particularly well, and it's playing to historic levels after the first 5 weeks in terms of touchdowns allowed and interceptions, turnovers gained. And, you know, how long can that continue? Remember, the only team they played that was supposed to be a top-flight team so far was Pittsburgh, and Ben Roethlisberger got hurt in that game and left partway through the game. But
would you not have the Bills as a top-flight team?
I had the Bills as a wild card in the AFC, partly because of that schedule. You know, it was obvious to me that they were the second best team.
But they benefit too from it.
Yeah, and they benefit from the schedule. And it was really just a case of Josh Allen taking that step up from his first season and being a more consistent passer, which he, after the first game, he did for a couple of weeks. And then against the Patriots, and this was my worry with the Patriots, he had a lot of open receivers in that game who he couldn't hit. And you could say, okay, the Patriots were giving them the underneath throws because they were challenging him to make those throws, and that was part of the game plan. But still, it's something that when you win only 16-10 and one of those touchdowns comes on a blocked punt, you know, you're kind of walking a tightrope if he does decide to finally complete those passes. So, you know, this week I don't think will be any different for New England because they're at home to the Giants, and we'll still have that question. And after that, they're against the Jets. Right. So it's kind of like a New Jersey derby for them back to back.
Safe to say they will be unbeaten in a couple of weeks when we talk about them again. Offensively, Mike, looking particularly at the dynamic and balance of the running game and the passing game. And of course, they use James White out of the backfield, spraying it around. So looking at statistically, Edelman is their leading receiver at the moment, but they're all kind of bunched together, really. Dorsett, Gordon, James White from the backfield, all around the 200, 250 yard mark in terms of receptions. Are they missing? Are they expecting, say, Gordon to step up more and more as the season progresses? Are they missing that number one receiver they were trying to get in Antonio Brown? Does it matter with this offense that is obviously without Gronkowski and is different from years gone by?
Yeah, it does matter because they don't have a mismatch nightmare for defenses to kind of allow for. And Gronk was always that mismatch. If you double team him, then it leaves people like Gordon or Edelman able to get open. If you don't double team him, he's going to outrun a linebacker and outmuscle a safety. So there was always that threat when Gronk was in the lineup. And, you know, when the Patriots offense was at its best, they either had Randy Moss on the outside or they had Gronk, Hernandez at tight end. So you could always get some kind of mismatch. It's interesting that Ben Watson came off the suspended list and they've released him rather than activate him.
Yeah, what's all that about, you think?
Well, it's partly financial, but partly that they think I don't think they believe he would give them much that they're not getting from Lacoste and Izzo, who are the two tight ends on the roster. And he's certainly not, you know, at 38, he's not a Gronk. He's not going to give them any sort of mismatch advantage. I think they think they've gotten enough good blocking and receiving, and they use those two tight ends more in this game than they had before. They also had to bring – they re-signed Jordan Richards, whose only problems as a safety are that he can't tackle and can't cover. But as a special teams player, he's pretty good, and that's why he's there, because they've had injuries in the special teams department. A bigger worry for them is watching their offensive line kind of get together. And remember, you know, Marshall Newhouse is their starting left tackle. Now, Trent Brown was one thing last year, you know, at 380 pounds, and they moved him to left tackle, and he was a huge success. Marshall Newhouse isn't as powerful as Trent Brown, probably isn't as quick as Trent Brown, and pass blocking in particular, he's more of a liability. But if you watched the game against Washington, you saw that after a pretty mediocre first half, they adjusted and decided to run with the running game and also to bring in the fullback more, the German kid from the University of Tennessee. Remember, we talked about him because he was the one international player who went on the practice squad, but without the designation so that they could activate him.
Jacob Johnson.
Jacob Johnson, and now he was activated, and he played pretty well.
Rufus is a fan.
Yeah, we didn't even mention the...
you did earlier. It was a delayed response to the Jets from about 4 minutes ago.
Yeah. People listening ought to realize that most of my information comes from my dog, who watches far more games than I do. But they played really well in the second half and got some of the running game going, which is important to them. But they still lack that one dimension. I think they're probably still looking around. You've seen rumors about them possibly drafting for Tyler Eifert, but of course... Extra Eifert is the guy who always winds up on the IR. So that's a risk. Emmanuel Sanders in Denver, although after a win, I think John Elway probably thinks Denver's now on their march to the Super Bowl, so they wouldn't give up Sanders. But the Patriots tried to get him when he was a free agent a couple of years ago. And, you know, they really do need that one more person who can create some kind of mismatch advantage for them. And fortunately, as you said, I mean, the whole truth of this matter is that the schedule treats them very well, although there is a point in this schedule in week 8 where Baltimore has a bye week, okay, and New England is playing Cleveland, and then New England has to go to Baltimore on Sunday to play in prime time. So, you know, it's unusual sort of to have a bye week and then host the prime time game. And that's going to be the game where New England, you know, if they get past Cleveland, if Cleveland don't pull up what will be an upset at that point, I think New England, Baltimore in week 9 is going to be the game of the week.
Mark that in your diaries. And also the trade deadline that Mike was referring to, of course, moving up fast. October the 29th is when teams have to get their deals done by if they are going to re-up. So watch that space. And interesting that Jason LaCanfora, the NFL writer over in the States, talking about the New York Jets potentially being one of those teams that, unsurprisingly, given the season they're having, might be open to bids for some of their stars. So it'll get quite interesting as it
Le'Veon, near Le'Veon Bell and his contract.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if they do. It would be a very Jet. Actually, I don't want to say that because I don't want to get Rufus excited again. Let's move on to, I want to talk MVP with you, Mike, because as we've talked about a fair bit on the show already this season, the MVP is usually a quarterback. That's typically how the cards fall there. Adrian Peterson, the exception to that rule in recent years in terms of offensive players, but a couple of players, Dalvin Cook early on and certainly Christian McCaffrey, a couple of running backs forcing their way into the conversation that includes Patrick Mahomes, despite his indifferent performance because of injury against the Colts. That didn't help when it was friendly fire from one of his own clanking his ankle, and he was clearly off kilter as a result. Russell Wilson is right in the thick of it as well after another virtuoso performance from him. So it's an interesting shortlist at the moment, and there is still a hell of a lot of football to play. I want to ask, first of all, why don't other skill positions get the love in the MVP conversation as much as quarterbacks? How come it isn't more evenly spread?
Well, the main thing is that the quarterback, with the possible exception of a goaltender in ice hockey, is the single most important person in any team sport. You can't, you know, if you're going to win without a really good quarterback, you have to have an exceptional defense. Even if you have a 2,000-yard runner, you still need some quarterbacking to do it. And for a running back to get it, he needs to either have to, you know, be a 2,000-yard runner or be both a running receiving threat, which is what Christian McCaffrey is. Dalvin Cook has the potential to be a 2,000-yard runner, like AP was in Minnesota, and he's on a team that wants to run the ball all the time. So that makes him legitimate. Russell Wilson's in an interesting position because although the Seahawks say they want to run the ball all the time and they do well when Carson goes over 100 yards and doesn't fumble, they do depend on Russell Wilson more than I think any other team depends on their quarterback. And they have done since he came into the league.
More than the Packers, did you say?
Good point. I take that
point. We'll put it at a time.
But yeah, it's kind of the way Russell Wilson, actually, and Rodgers does the same thing to a lesser degree, but they really depend on Wilson to bail them out, in unlikely ways. And, I don't think now you would argue that Rodgers has more help than Wilson does. But in previous years, he probably did. And And Patrick Mahomes obviously is the key to the Chiefs, even when the Chiefs were loaded with playmakers, when Tyreek Hill and Hunt were both playing for the Chiefs. It was still Patrick Mahomes who was getting the benefit of their contribution. But football's the ultimate team game, and that's why the quarterback stands out so much, because he's the one person who is given a win or a loss when the team wins or lose. The one
context
player.
Obviously on that though, Mike. So if you take the Panthers and McCaffrey specifically, who at the moment is averaging 173.2 yards from scrimmage per game, which puts him on pace to have 2,771 if he keeps it up. And that would be a record, of course. Chris Johnson back in 2008, remember him, early days of us working together, 2,509 scrimmage record, or yards from scrimmage, I should say. Given the Cam Newton situation and Kyle Allen's come in and, you know, performed pretty creditably, there's not a knock on him, but there's no doubt about it that McCaffrey is carrying this team. So if that, this offense, certainly. So if that continues to happen, how much of the context of a situation and the literal interpretation of most valuable player gets applied there?
A lot. I think, and right now, I think McCaffrey's got an excellent, right now, I would put Wilson and McCaffrey 1-2 and Mahomes in 3.
Right.
Cause I think Mahomes is sort of inexorable in that offense. If he, you know, I said before the season, I think he's going to regress a little bit, this year, but if he throws 38 touchdown passes instead of 50, he's still an MVP candidate, and he's always going to be, because he's such a talented player. But right now I'd put Wilson and McCaffrey in those 1-2 spots, and Rodgers a sneaky sort of number 4, because, you know, the Packers are 4-1,
yeah.
Very quietly sort of, but again, they do, as you said, depend on Rodgers a lot.
Yeah, really, really fair point. And a nice segue, Mike, into our quarterback chat, I think, because you're going to have your top five, and I'm going to wheel my Desert Island top. You have a top five, right, this week, Mike, or are there a few more?
I usually do, yeah.
You usually have about 7 or 8. Okay, we'll get into that in a mo. But in terms of the construct of a great quarterback, and you have, you know, right now we've mentioned a few of them: Mahomes and Wilson, Breeze, Rodgers, Brady, of course, Roethlisberger, Rivers. These top tier quarterbacks that, at varying stages of their career, of course, as well. But it's unequivocally, I think, in the case of all of those players I've just mentioned, great quarterbacks. I don't think you'd find many people that would beg to differ on that front. And then you've got a whole bunch of players that range from average to pretty good, right? So you've got Jared Goff, Garoppolo on his day, Cousins, you know, Dalton maybe when he's on form. And maybe that's the point, Mike. Is that the key? Is it consistency week in, week out, most weeks, most seasons, building that up? That must be a different styles of quarterbacks we talked about as well. They're fundamentally different players, Brady and Mahomes. So talk us through what you think, having covered the game for so many years, makes a great quarterback.
Well, consistency is very, very important. And you know, Eli Manning, for example, you said we weren't going to talk Eli, but Eli Manning is a quarterback who is a big play kind of guy. He's got no memory in terms of bad plays. He's basically been a league average passer for most of his career, but he elevates his game somewhat statistically in the playoffs. And of course, as we know, he makes big throws in games when he made big throws in games when he needed to, which is
but
the
doesn't
basis.
That count as much? I mean, I hear you.
Well,
right?
That depends. I mean, that if you want to be a successful NFL team year in and year out, maybe not. And again, it's hard to separate quarterbacks from teams. Now, everyone thinks you have to have a great quarterback to get to the Super Bowl, but teams have won Super Bowls with Mark Rippon at quarterback, with Doug Williams at quarterback, with Brad Johnson at quarterback, with the aforementioned Trent Dilfer at quarterback.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to have a great quarterback. You have Jeff Hostetler won a Super Bowl for the Giants. You don't have to have a great quarterback to win a Super Bowl. Jim Plunkett won 2 Super Bowls with the Raiders, and I find him very comparable to Eli Manning. But when people talk about Manning being a lock for the Super Bowl, nobody talks about Jim Plunkett being a lock. Sorry, a lock for the Hall of Fame. Nobody talks about Jim Plunkett being a lock here. And I think there are a couple of things. The game is changing. it's, you know, it's so much more offense oriented, so much more passing oriented, I should say. And it's widening out from the influence of college football so that mobile quarterbacks are really a necessity almost nowadays. It's getting harder to play with simply a drop back kind of offense, which is what was the norm in football for the last, well, I don't know, 50, 60 years, which is how quarterbacks were evaluated. You wanted a guy who was big enough to see over the pocket, had strong enough to avoid a rush or to, you know, absorb a rush and stand in against the rush, Ben Roethlisberger being the epitome, and had a big arm. And I think arm strength in particular, size as a secondary factor, but those two things are the two most overrated characteristics when sure. people are evaluating quarterbacks. And what is most necessary is accuracy. I think more than anything, more than arm strength, you have to be accurate. It doesn't make any difference if you can throw the ball 40 yards and can't put it on a button at 10, because consistency, as you suggested, is the most important thing. You can't move the chains if you can't throw consistently. And when you're playing a team like, say, Carolina or Buffalo, who do this very, very well, they play a lot of zone defense that allows you completions underneath on the precept that if you can put together 8 or 10 completions on a drive, well, more power to you. But we're not going to let you do that. You know, we're going to hit your receivers hard when they go underneath. We're going to give you the 3 yard gain when it's third down and 7, and you're not going to get the first down. So I think accuracy is still underrated when people evaluate coaches. And the second thing is smarts, football smarts.
Sure.
It's being able to see and release quickly and put the ball accurately where it's supposed to go. And some of our greatest quarterbacks, Tom Brady and Peyton Manning being probably the two most obvious kind of examples of it, would come out of the huddle, survey the field, and know where the ball was going to go by the way the defense was aligned. Now, part of that is smarts and part of it is hard work in terms of studying film and watching tendencies, but it's being able to put that together in your mind to do that. And I think I called it the three R's back in our Channel 5 days, which was something like read, react, release. And that to me is still the key for being a successful quarterback in this league. Now, you can add nowadays sort of escapability or, you know, giving your offense that multiple
improvisation and keeping the player alive.
Yeah, which is what makes Russell Wilson so good, because to an extent he does both. Mahomes is so far, from what I've seen, excellent at doing both.
Roethlisberger's had a vibe of that as well, hasn't he, in a different kind of way, just because of his physicality, and he just kind of...
That's what I said. Ben is the epitome of the guy who can stand in against the rush and let it go, and he gets hurt as a result. And then you have guys, I think Philip Rivers is in this group, and he's as tough as they come. We're talking about he'll stand in against a rush like everybody. But there's guys like Rivers. I put Matt Stafford in that group. John Elway was, I think, a guy like that who always think that Jeff George was another one who will stand in. Elway had mobility, but they will wait for the play to be open and always think they could force the ball in. Brett Favre's another one in that group.
Mayfield's that kind of player, isn't he?
Well, I think he wants to be, but he shouldn't be. Mayfield, to be successful, has to be more like Drew Brees than Brett Favre. He has, you know, and that's what Kitchens was trying to do for him. He's mobile enough to be able to do the kinds of things that a Kyler Murray does in an offense. He runs better than people think, but he's not going to be a gunner. And the difference between a Brett Favre and an Elway and a Stafford or a Jeff George is simply a little bit of anticipation. What you get with Stafford a lot is that he's waiting for the receiver to come open and then pushing the ball in. Whereas Steve Young, say, would be throwing the ball before the receiver comes open.
The extra second.
And that makes all the difference. So that's a Brady or a Manning. knowing where he thinks, you know, the play's going to be, where the open receiver's going to be, will throw that ball before the receiver makes his cut sometimes. Watch that Atlanta second half, and you'll see Brady throw a couple of sidelines patterns where the ball is on its way before the receiver has even cut. Mm. And it's coming right where the receiver is going to be. And if you combine that with the arm strength, then you've got the perfect quarterback. But
well, speaking of which, let's have Iron Mike's top five. So Iron Mike's top five quarterbacks of all time. And I'm guessing what we've just been talking about for the last 5 minutes paints the considerations, I think, that we are weighing in here. So while I've gone for a more personal favorite players I like to see, there might be an element of that in your makeup, Mike, but you're picking, I guess, based on quarterback.
I was being analytical. My personal favorites include guys like Charlie Johnson of the St. Louis Cardinals and John Hadel of the San Diego Chargers. And
you look them up, kids.
Which is, yeah. Well, again, when you're young and you see these guys, they were both kind of gunslinger types, in their era. Jim Hart of the Cardinals, I liked a lot. In fact, the Cardinals had a run of pretty good, but mediocre quarterbacks.
good, but mediocre.
I was a big fan of Bobby Hebert, too.
Bobby Hebert, you would say it's deep dive. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, he was with the Michigan Panthers in the USFL, which is when he and Anthony Carter had one great year and tore that league up. But, now this is my top five. It sort of stays more or less the same. Certainly, I think the top four does, and the fifth one is kind of a movable feast. And I change the way I rank the two, three, four guys, you know, every time I think about it. And then the next five, obviously. It's no, because the NFL's been going for 100 years. So before everybody gets all upset, you know, there's no disgrace to not being in the top five quarterbacks.
And fair enough.
Especially when you're, you know, when I've got John Unitas or Sid Luckman or Roger Staubach or Breeze and Rogers or Lenny Dawson or, you know, Dan Marino, sort of below the surface.
Wait a minute. Marino's not in your top five.
He's not in my top
five.
No,
we are having words.
But he probably cuts the top 10. So don't get upset.
Great. He'll be happy about that. All right.
Yeah, so number five is Steve Young, who I think is maybe in terms of the whole athletic package, the best quarterback of all time. He's arguably the best running quarterback of all time. He was a hugely accurate passer with a strong arm. But I put him at number five while having Joe Montana at number four just ahead of him. And I'm not quite convinced of the reason for it.
Are you going to change your top five as we're going along, Mike? I think I get a sense you might be.
I could talk myself into it. Montana's the ultimate system quarterback.
And
this is something that people argue about all the time.
Brady.
You know, the system.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get to that in a second. Okay. Drew Brees is a system quarterback in that sense. And the thing is, you don't know how Montana would fare in another system very much, because when he went to Kansas City, it was kind of the end of his career.
Sure.
He did relatively well as well. But Bart
it's like
Starr,
Jordan of the Wizards, right? I mean, yeah. It's just not you.
Bart Starr is in that category. You know, people would say that Dawson, who's very similar to Bart Starr in a lot of ways, is in that category. So those two are four and five. Mm-hmm. The two 49ers just ahead. I think John Unitas was my number six. In third place is Peyton Manning, for a lot of the reasons that I said before, being house smart. And Manning was a system quarterback as well, only it was Manning's system.
Sure.
No matter, when he went to Denver, he did the same thing that he did in Indianapolis. And I think when people denigrate Manning's second year in Denver because he didn't play well, he was very creaky. Osweiler replaced him for a few games, you know, and did every bit probably as well as Manning. But he did quarterback that team to a Super Bowl as Trent Dilfer. And that was actually an accomplishment, I think, you know, for a guy who's at that point, his physical skills were limited by injury. So I've got him in at number three.
Jeff Dickerson was in the house on Friday, Mike, I'm sure. I know, because you not only do you subscribe and download. You also listen to the show, I know,
of
as well.
Course.
So you would have heard that.
Wouldn't miss a minute.
That Madden came up actually in that very context, that final year, that Super Bowl year, where he was clearly a shadow of his former self, the high point, the apex of his career physically, but had those football smarts as well, and got it done. So yeah, a really, really fair point. So those are your 5-4-3. Who are the top two?
Top two. Tom Brady's number two. And, you know, people say Brady's a system quarterback. It's true to a sense, but the problem is that the system is Bill Belichick's system and it changes every week. Sure. Brady has won, he's won throwing 50 touchdown passes with Randy Moss in the lineup. He's won with a run first lineup with Corey Dillon. But most seasons he wins doing those things and more. You know, and whatever they need executed, Brady's able to execute that, really well. And, you know, there used to be the argument of how would Peyton Manning do on a Belichick team and how would Brady do in Indianapolis? And I think that was always a fascinating one because how much would Peyton Manning want to
control things
and, you know, and change the plays and do what he thought and,
right.
and how good would his judgment be? You know, and probably pretty good. And,
isn't every quarterback a system quarterback, Mike, to some extent?
Yeah. And it's funny because my number one guy was a system quarterback back in the days when quarterbacks called their own plays. And that's a big thing. People, you know, the difference between quarterbacks in the pre-passing era and quarterbacks today isn't only that the rules let them throw a lot and that you can throw far more, you know, than you do. But that they called their own plays. So signal calling was an important part of the job. And a guy like a Bart Starr or a John Unitas, was able to come, or Lanny Dawson was able to come up to the line and have that vision to be able to see what play he had called in the huddle thinking what was going to go and then what he could switch at the time. Bobby Lane is a Hall of Fame quarterback who didn't have a very good arm, but was incredibly tough and was a great reader of games. And could, you know, could call those right kind of plays. Sid Luckman was kind of like that. And I think it's interesting too that Sid Luckman, for example, is still the greatest quarterback the Bears have ever had.
Sure.
Without an argument. There's not, you know, Sammy Baugh is a great player as well as a great quarterback.
Jim Amon won him a Super Bowl, but was,
yeah. You can argue one or two other Washington quarterbacks are up there in the Sammy Baugh category, more or less, Sonny Jurgensen being the most obvious one. But, you know, Sid Luckman is still undisputedly the best quarterback the Bears have ever had. And he played in the early 1940s through the mid 40s. And that's
the way Trubisky's going is, yeah, he's going to hold on to that match.
He's going to another,
years,
he's got yeah. another couple of years.
Actually,
you know, every time one of these guys comes up, he probably, if he were alive, he would be sitting at home popping the champagne cork like the Dolphins do. But that's true as well. Of the guy who's at number one for me was Otto Graham. Otto Graham of the Cleveland Browns. And he's still the best quarterback the Cleveland Browns have ever had. He was the first quarterback the Cleveland Browns ever had. Graham played 10 years in 4 years in the All-American Football Conference where the Browns won all 4 years. They came into the NFL and they won the NFL championship the first year. In fact, the first game they came back in the NFL, they beat the reigning champion Eagles who had won 2 years in a row. And then they went to the championship game every single year that he played. They didn't win them all, obviously, but he played 10 years in the major leagues, as it were, and he went to 10 championship games. Paul Brown talked him out of retirement for the 10th. When Graham left in 1957, they drafted Jim Brown. They were trying to get Len Dawson, strangely enough, who then withered until he got to the AFL in 1962. But they had Jim Brown. They won one title with Jim Brown, the greatest right. running back of all time. Graham, they went to 10 championship games and they won seven of them, if I remember
wow.
correctly.
Yeah.
I think in the modern game, I mean, he'd be small, obviously, because everybody was smaller. He ran pretty well. But Graham was the guy who Paul Brown insisted on calling all the plays. And he would shuttle guards in with the play to the huddle. And Graham hated it. Graham at one point said they would have, you know, they might never have lost if he'd been calling the plays instead of Paul Brown. It was the one thing that they differed on. But he's the most successful quarterback, I think, for good reason. He's the best quarterback the Browns have ever had for good reason. And so he's still number one. And when I played my first college game, which was a freshman game against the Coast Guard Academy's freshman team, my father came down from work to watch the game, and after the game, I was playing both ways, split end and defensive end, which is an unusual mix, even at that level. And I came back and my father came up and said, "Oh, you know, good game. And I said, "Oh, what did you, you know, how did I do?" And he goes, "Oh, look, there's Otto Graham." And Otto Graham was the head coach and athletic director at the Ghost Guard Academy at that point. So he didn't really care about what I'd done because Otto Graham was there. And maybe that influences my pick, but that's my top five, today. Young, Montana, Manning, Brady, and Graham.
Love the picks, Mike. And I figured Otto Graham would be in the mix because he is someone you put me onto early on in us working together. And I figured he might appear in your top five. This is a great story that maybe sums him up and just how hardcore and tough he was. He was injured in a game. An opponent's elbow smacked him in the face. He had required 15 stitches. This was a game in 1953 against the 49ers. Had 15 stitches at halftime. Went out wearing a face mask. And took them to a 23-21 win. So 15 stitches, got them sorted out at halftime, and went on and won the game for the Browns.
Yeah, I think some people give Paul Brown credit for inventing the face mask, which that might have been the cause for it. After the war, Otto Graham, before he signed with Cleveland, had nothing to do in the winter. So he played basketball for the Rochester Royals, who were in what was then called the National Basketball League. And of course, they won the championship.
Well, of course, anything he played, he would have destroyed everyone at Monopoly, I'm sure. My top five, super quick, and then we'll get to the mailbag. And remember, this is based on players that I just love watching, that have a sentimental value for me. And I wanted a kind of diversity of styles as well, because if I'm sitting there on a desert island watching hour-long worth of footage, I want to mix it up a bit. So
I know who's going to be number one.
Yeah, you do? Okay,
I do.
Write it down on a bit of paper. And we'll see.
I just did. I just told my dog.
Okay. It's not Ken O'Brien, Rufus, although I would I'd have him as an outsider. Carson Palmer is my, seeing as Mike always has more than five, is my just missed, clearly not, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, but just the way he threw the ball before the knee injury in particular as well. Carson Palmer in the early years of his career as a Bengal, just love an elegant passer, and he is one of them. Michael Vick is my number five. Forget his off the field transgressions and all of that nonsense. On the field, video game style, Michael Vick, electrifying, and a seminal player in recent NFL history, I think, for that reason only. Peyton Manning is number four for reasons Mike has eloquently outlined already, the football smarts. Jim Kelly is my number three, just because it was that era that when I was falling in love with the game, and Kelly was presiding over this brilliant Buffalo Bills team that didn't win, of course, never won the big show, but also for his off-the-field strength and what he's become. One of the highlights, Mike, of you and I working together was when he came into the booth when we were doing one of the games at Wembley, and hell of a player, hell of a guy. So Jim Kelly, my number three. Russell Wilson is my number two. Again, we've covered Russell Wilson pretty comprehensively on the show today, but for that improvisation and just that sense that anything can happen with Russell Wilson, despite the limitations around him at times, and I think he's going to go on to even greater things. And number one, because it's an absolute homer pick, of course it's Dan Marino.
Of course
he has Dan Marino on there. I don't care what you're saying. I'm disappointed he didn't make your top five, Mike. He was the greatest passer of the ball I've ever seen. And in a team that flattered to deceive, that 80s Miami Dolphins team with the Marx Brothers and the team that that got me onto, and mentioned Ken O'Brien, those games against the Jets early doors in the mid late 80s, those two going at it, ridiculous score lines, ridiculously high wire offense. Marino, who of course his trajectory into the NFL, his draft stock dropped and all of that element to him, they had a point to prove and he went on and did it and then some. And the fact that I feel for the guy, he doesn't have that ring, which is always going to be an asterisk on his career. But Marino, take solace. You don't have a Super Bowl ring, but you are number one in my
yeah, that was never in doubt. Although I like elevating the Jim Kelly pick too, because Kelly, I think, is your ultimate gunslinger in a way.
Yes.
And had an offense that really let him do that. And I think part of the game plan that for the Giants that beat the Bills in the Super Bowl, on the famous Norwood missed field goal, was predicated on Kelly not being able to deviate from the game plan. you know, not recognizing what they were giving and what they were taking away. That's kind of like the hidden secret in Belichick's game plan there.
Of course, he was the defensive coordinator of that Giants side, wasn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. And supposedly the game plan is sitting in the Hall of Fame right now. There's this wonderful moment in one of those NFL films things where they're talking about Belichick as the coordinator in the Giants, and Bill says something about how, you know, Bill Parcells let them, you know, gave them the reign to do things, and Belichick's on the sidelines talking to, and maybe it was Lawrence Taylor or somebody, and Parcells comes over and says, Bill, you know, we got to take care of you. We got it covered, Bill. We've got it covered, Bill. I'm talking about Bill, we got it covered. And Parcells kind of mopes away. I've always loved that just little clip. And then you wonder why he didn't want to stay in the Jets under Parcells management.
Right. Let's dive to the mailbag. Thanks to Cameron Hall for his tweet at the NC show, incidentally, if you want to follow suit. In the year of backup quarterbacks, the top five seasons for a backup quarterback. Maybe we could do that for you next week, Mike.
Sure.
Fancy that?
Sure. I already know who's going to be number one.
Oh, good. Okay.
And he's not a million miles removed from your favorite team.
Oh, God. Okay. I'm looking forward to that. It's not Cleo Lemon, is it? I really hope leave Cleo alone. All right. That is a bit of homework for you for next week. Now, here's a good one, which maybe you can expand upon the initial question and feed into possible candidates for this gig. So the question is pretty straightforward. Why do my beloved Redskins suck? Asks Mark. There are a lot of how long have you got? But let's maybe roll that into who might be a good fit in terms of head coach contenders for them. Which of course will be there'll be an interim situation till next season. So is it going to be a veteran head coach, a zeitgeist coordinator that's going to get the step up? Who do you think could succeed there?
It's a huge question because I think the corollary to that is who's going to want to go there.
Right.
I mean, there's always someone who does, you know, because the opportunity to be a head coach is too enticing, but it's a bad situation. And a lot of people blame the owner, but I think Dan Snyder's interference, as it were, or impatience has been lessened in the past few years. And it's really Bruce Allen, the general manager, who has to bear the brunt of this. You know, he's forced out the best personnel guy that they had, taken most of that over himself. He, has not handled player negotiations or acquisition well. They tend to pay for players at positions where their need is not greatest. They don't build much depth and they've had bad injury luck for a couple of seasons. But of course, injury luck is something that good teams or consistently good teams tend to avoid better because they have assembled depth and they can integrate the lesser players into their systems. I'm thinking particularly of the Patriots now, but there are other teams that have done it pretty well over the years, like the Ravens. You know, and obviously if you lose your starting quarterback and you don't have a great backup, but you know, remember Matt Castle going 11-5 with the Patriots.
Sure.
And you know, they had this long dance with Kirk Cousins where instead of giving him a long-term contract, they kept franchising him, which meant they paid him more than they would have if they'd signed him to a long-term contract, but had the advantage of telling him, we don't think you're our long-term guy, which is not the way you want to run your quarterbacking situation. Now they've got Trent Williams, who, you know, even at his age and not as great as he once was, but still pretty damn good. He's their best lineman and he's not playing because he's got a feud with them over the way they handled his injury and they haven't addressed it. They haven't done anything with him. They haven't traded him. They haven't, you know, reached a settlement to get him back on the field. That's just bad management. And having said that, there's all this argument over who drafted Dwayne Haskins. Oh, which is not a bad draft pick, but you can't then draft him and say, well, we don't have any confidence in him, which is sure. Kind of what they were saying, you know, kind of half-heartedly. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of Jay Gruden was when he was asked if Colt McCoy was going to be the starter on, I think it was Thursday last week. And he said, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. And he said, who's going to start out of all three of them? It was, you could understand the frustration there. I mean, that was,
so, you know, I think it's a terrible situation. It's just, and I don't know who's going to want. Bill Callahan is fine as an interim coach. You know, he's been a head coach. You remember when Gruden left, he was promoted in Oakland. And then when they got to the Super Bowl, he was still running Gruden's offense, including the nomenclature. So the Raiders knew every play. the Bucks knew every play the Raiders were going to run. I think there's some sentiment, I think, for the team to promote from inside, which would mean skipping Callahan, because I don't think anybody sees Callahan as the long-term solution in Washington. But Kevin O'Connell, who's the offensive coordinator, who you may or may not remember watching when we were in the Patriots camp many years ago for Channel 5. He was one of the backups, and he never actually made it in the NFL, but he's a very highly regarded offensive coordinator now. And some people are mentioning him as a potential head coach. You know, they've also got Greg Minuski, who is the defense coordinator. His brother's been a head coach. Rob Ryan probably would like the job, but I don't think on a team that needs more discipline, Rob's your answer. Right. Ray Horton's been around a long time in the secondary. They've got a bunch of guys who are potential head coaches there, but I really think that what they need is someone who's going to come in and, to some extent, either clean house or kick butt. Or both. But I mean, you know, if you clear out everybody, then you don't have their butts to kick.
Fair point. Well, back to your right to the top of the show, Mike, you better get on that phone and return the phone calls because you'd definitely be the guy I would pick for a kick in a bit.
Now, being the Redskins, the guy they might well be most interested in is Mike McCarthy, who's kind of like the biggest successful name out there without a job.
Well, thanks for the question. Appreciate that. And sorry we didn't have time to get into more. All those of you who have been sending them in, we'll do our very best. Just reboot again and try it again next week.
Answered your question on the show, I'll break protocol and answer some
of
them.
I'll do it on Twitter, Why break the habit of a lifetime? I love it. Now we've recorded the show, you're allowed to do that. That's good. Cracking stuff, as ever. Iron Mike, if you want to follow the big man at Carlson Sports on Twitter, and of course his weekly Patreon column, patreon.com/MikeCarlsonFMTE. Get involved with that. And I will see you Sunday at Spurs for the Bucks Panthers.
Yeah, looking forward to that. That's actually going to be a really good game, I think, and a test of the Panthers' defense, what I was talking about before, of holding things underneath. The Bucks are a team that want to beat you over the top if they can. So I'm looking forward to that. And, of course, based on last week, it's such a nice venue to do a game at. And our position for radio is just so perfect for seeing the game.
Loved it. And I'm looking forward to Sunday. Look after yourself, mate. I'll see you then.
Okay, see you then.
Crackers down from Iron Mike. We would not expect anything less. And how about that? We set his homework for next week as well. Incidentally, if you've got a top five for Iron Mike to consider on our Wednesday show, fire it in on social media at the NC Show. We will take it under consideration. And even if we don't do it that week, we might well stack it up for weeks to come, because we are here all through the season up to and including the Super Bowl in Miami. So make sure you stay with us for all the key NFL news and chat. Jason Bell's dropping by on the show very soon as well. We've got Ben Isaacs, as I said earlier, in the house on Friday, our Saturday fantasy show as well. Ollie Giel, the OG, getting you set for some daily fantasy thanks to our headline sponsors, Paddy Power Fantasy. Appreciate their support as ever. Incidentally, the London game, the second London game at Spurs this weekend, you might well be heading to that. And if you are, enjoy it. And if you're not, or if you are and you're thinking, this is great, but I also want to check something out stateside, go to touchdowntrips.com. These guys will get that sorted for you to customize a trip, whether it's to an NFL game, a college game, a high school game, or all of the above. If you want to go and see your beloved Carolina Panthers or Tampa Bay Bucks over stateside, head to touchdowntrips.com and they will take care of business for you. They come highly recommended. Right then, Ben Isaacs in the house on Friday. We'll see you then. Bye for now, guys.